Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran says the recent riot in the country paved the way for separatist groups and Daesh terrorists to carry out brutal attacks against the people. A senior UN official calls for an immediate probe into the killing of a Palestinian youth by Israeli forces, saying those responsible must be held accountable. And Russia slams a price cap put on its oil by the U.S. and its allies, claiming that, quote, ill-conceived actions for the current imbalances in the energy markets. Hello and welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Tehran says rioters created the recent unrest in Iran, paving the way for separatist groups and terrorist organizations to conduct brutal attacks against the people. Interior Ministry says separatist groups infiltrated Iran's border provinces to stir up ethnic and sectarian violence. According to the Security Council of the Interior Ministry, the enemies pursued their goals by waging psychological warfare and spreading fake news about the deaths caused during the unrest. More than 200 people have reportedly lost their lives since the riots began in mid-September. The figure includes security forces, innocent people, as well as rioters. The riots began after the death of young woman Mahsa Amini, who died in the hospital several days after collapsing at a police station in Tehran. Political commentator Scott Bennett says Western spy agencies are fomenting the riots in Iran in an attempt to destabilize the country.
The West and the CIA and the British Mossad and the Israeli Mossad and the British MI6 are trying desperately to destabilize Iran, to try and foment cover revolutions, to try and foment ethnic strife. They're trying to, by any means necessary, create conflict and division and animosity in order to break Iran apart and exploit those fractures into something that could be used to destabilize and tear the country apart and ultimately rape and pillage Iran and steal its natural resources. So any kind of protest or division should be recognized as a foreign infiltration operation. And the Iranian leadership, the religious leadership, the academic leadership, the political leadership, and the media in Iran should expose and condemn any of these protests as an act of foreign intervention.
Canada has announced additional sanctions against Iran over what it describes as human rights violations, as well as actions threatening international peace. The new measures target four individuals over their involvement in the Iranian government's response to the recent unrest there. Five entities are targeted also. They include two Iranian technology firms accused of cooperating with the government in transferring drones to Russia for the use in the Ukraine war. Canada and its Western allies allege that Russia has used the Iranian drones against civilians in Ukraine. Iran has strongly denied that. It says it gave the aircraft to Russia prior to the Ukraine war and as part of mutual defense cooperation. Iran also denies human rights violations against its people. The country in November put sanctions on a Canadian entity and eight individuals in a reciprocal move. Author and journalist Arnold August believes that Canada follows U.S. policies when it comes to Iran and many other countries.
The Canadian government, over the last few years, with regards to many countries, but specifically with regards to Iran, they simply use the U.S. State Department and White House talking points against Iran. So that is the pretext, that is so-called repression of women in Iran. Interesting, coming from a country, Canada, a colonial settler state that is now famous throughout the world for having committed and still commits genocide against the native peoples in our country, they are in a position, a moral position, to judge Iran with regards to the question of human rights. I mean, it is basically a regime change effort pushed forward by the United States and Canada, unfortunately, as a very close and faithful ally of the United States, is following through on it by adding these sanctions.
People in Bahrain have taken to the streets in protest at the upcoming trip by Israeli President Isaac Herzog to their country. The protesters gathered in several areas of Bahrain on Friday, chanting death to Israel. They also carried signs with Herzog's image, calling him criminal. Opposition activists launched a campaign on social media also, speaking out against normalization with Israel. Herzog is set to arrive in Bahrain on Sunday. He will be the first Israeli president to visit the Arab country. Bahrain, along with the UAE and Morocco, normalized ties with the regime in 2020 under a U.S.-backed deal. The move sparked Muslims' anger, who called it a betrayal to the Palestinian cause. The U.N. Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process is urging an immediate investigation into the killing of Palestinians by Israeli forces. Tor Wennesland says that he was horrified to see an Israeli soldier kill a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank on Friday. He called for those responsible to be held accountable. Footage showed an Israeli soldier shooting a 23-year-old Palestinian at point-blank range four times at a checkpoint in Nablus. He was left bleeding on the ground, while Israeli forces prevented emergency ambulances from helping him. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has vowed revenge, saying that the killing shows the fascist nature of the Tel Aviv regime. Hamas stressed that the crime should prompt all international human rights organizations to hold the Israeli regime accountable. Russia has rejected the plan by the EU and G7 to impose a $60 price cap on its oil exports. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the price cap is not acceptable to Moscow. The Russian-U.S. embassy argues that the plan by the EU and G7 will result in increasing uncertainty and higher costs for oil importers. The embassy says the West energy sanctions on Russia and other restrictive measures have already hurt energy security in developing countries. It also blames the West's ill-conceived actions for the current imbalances in energy markets. The price cap will come into effect soon. The EU has also imposed a ban on seaborne imports of Russian oil. Ukraine has welcomed the price cap, hoping that it will destroy Russia's economy. Kyiv wants the cap to be lowered to $30 so that it would be able to destroy the Russian economy even more quickly. The U.S. president has recently shown interest to speak with his Russian counterpart directly, hoping to end the Ukraine war, which has hurt the West badly. His willingness to talk to Putin has some strings attached to it, as well as some ifs, buts, and maybes.
The U.S. president said on Thursday that he would be willing to speak to Vladimir Putin if he truly wants to end the war. That was the first time he had expressed willingness to speak with the Russian leader since the beginning of the war in February, around which time he said that he will not be speaking with Putin. He made his comments as he was delivering a speech at a joint White House news conference with French President Emmanuel Macron. Here's what he said about the war in Ukraine and the unrealistic conditions under which he would speak to Putin.
Look, there's one way for this war to end, the rational way. Putin to pull out of Ukraine, number one. But it appears he's not going to do that. But the fact of the matter is, I have no immediate plans to contact Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin is, let me choose my words very carefully. I'm prepared to speak with Mr. Putin if, in fact, there is an interest in him deciding he's looking for a way to end the war. He hasn't done that yet.
Biden further added, if that's the case, in consultation with my French and my NATO friends, I'll be happy to sit down with Putin to see what he has in mind, as he and Macron vowed long-term support for Ukraine. The Kremlin took note of Biden's comments and responded through its spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. He said that Putin remains open to negotiations, but he is not going to pull his troops out of Ukraine. Peskov emphasized another unrealistic condition that Biden had set for talking with Putin. That would be the West's refusal to recognize the quote-unquote new territories that Russia annexed during the controversial September referendums. All that said, Peskov was not dismissive of the potentiality of talks between the two superpowers. While outlining Russia's conditions for the talks, he said, President Putin has been, is, and remains open for contacts for negotiations. Of course, the most preferable way to achieve our interests is through peaceful diplomatic means. While it is difficult to assess both parties' actual willingness to talk, what is objectively true is the fact that President Biden had not expressed any willingness to sit down with Putin, with or without the unrealistic conditions he set. Could it be that the very difficult winter ahead of Ukraine and the rest of Europe is making the West reconsider negotiating with Putin?
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has spoken to President Putin on the phone to call for peace talks. Also, the French President Macron, in a joint White House press conference with his American counterpart, emphasized the pursuit of peace talks.
While President Biden was playing fast and loose with the idea of holding peace talks and simultaneously setting unrealistic prerequisites for it, President Macron expressed a more dovish tone by simply saying, "I will continue to talk to President Putin," as he called for efforts, quote, "to prevent escalation and to achieve concrete results." Macron also stated that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has also shown, quote-unquote, real willingness to pursue peace. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke with President Putin on the phone and urged the Russian leader to find a diplomatic solution to the war as soon as possible. Scholz also called for the Russian troops to fully withdraw from Ukraine, an unlikely scenario to unfold. Putin told Scholz on the phone that Germany and the entire Western Bloc's approach towards Ukraine was destructive, as he called on Scholz to rethink his approach. It is unclear whether or not Germany, France, or the U.S. would initiate peace talks with Russia, but it seems that, at the very least, they are leaving the option on the table, despite some major disagreements between the two sides on the prerequisites for the talks. Something that was expected to hurt the potentiality of peace talks, but doesn't seem to now, is the price cap that was going to be imposed on Russian oil by the G7, EU, and Australia. They have, in fact, imposed the price cap at $60 per Russian crude oil barrel, but the amount is actually well above what Russian oil is trading for right now. This means that Russian oil will still flow, and that the West has not been able to find an alternative source to Russian oil, as Russia is still the major oil provider for the countries setting the price cap. The chair of Russian Lower House's Foreign Affairs Committee, Leonid Slutsky, believes that the price cap will only end up jeopardizing EU's energy security as the world waits to see how Russia will react to the move.
The Italian parliament has passed a resolution authorizing the government to continue to help Ukraine, including via military aid, throughout the year 2023. This as an increasing number of Italians are advocating for peace negotiations to end the Russian-Ukraine conflict.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including Centre-Left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defence.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kiev. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance in with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kyiv.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war. This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
South Korean workers have rallied in the capital, Seoul, in support of the ongoing strike by truckers. The protesters, including truckers, were workers from South Korea's biggest labor union. It said about 5,000 workers joined the rally taking place near the National Assembly. Saturday marks the 10th day of a nationwide strike by Korean truckers. More than 20,000 have stopped working to demand better pay. The government has ordered them to get back on the road because the action has disrupted supply chains. It has also said that it would not expand the minimum pay system for truckers beyond a further 3 years. The unions reject that. And that is for World News. Do stay with us.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
A Yemeni news channel has revealed footage of what it described as mostly African migrants from Ethiopia murdered by Saudi regime troops. Survivors of this gruesome crime say this wanton killing of African migrants is carried out on a daily basis. This revelation has taken the oil-rich kingdom's record of atrocities against Africans to a whole new level. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on new evidence of how Saudi Arabia is committing atrocities against poor African migrants in the kingdom. We are asking, what is the source of this appalling and pervasive culture of impunity in Saudi Arabia? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight and send us your comments through our social media handle as you watch.
Massacre of Africans in Saudi Arabia. The world has been shocked but not surprised by footage released by Yemeni Al Masira news channel showing shocking images of Ethiopian migrants murdered by Saudi border guards. The Saudi regime is known for its cruelty and crimes against humanity, but the massacre of innocent Africans has raised concern about the growing levels of impunity and belligerence in this authoritarian kingdom.
The survivors said Saudi border guards at the country's border with Yemen shoot directly at the migrants, often using mortars. According to the survivors, Saudi forces kill about 5 migrants at the border every day and injure many more. For years, human rights organizations have also denounced the horrible conditions of detention of Ethiopian migrants in Saudi Arabia. Now, to discuss the latest Saudi atrocities and crimes against Africans in the repressive kingdom, we have contacted Margaret Kimberly, the co-founder of the Black Agenda Report. Thanks for your time, madam, today.
Thank you for having me.
We also have with us here Zakir Ahmed, a lawyer, activist, and political analyst. Thanks a lot also for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, let's start off with Ms. Kimberly. Can you tell us more about this massacre of Ethiopian migrants by Saudi regime border guards?
Well, this is something that's been discovered recently, the bodies of Ethiopians attempting to enter Saudi Arabia to work. It's part of a long pattern of discrimination against African migrants to that country, to Saudi Arabia, and to other countries in the region. They depend on migrant labor, but treat them very badly, treating Africans particularly badly, and in this case, even killing people.
The Saudi Arabia regime is infamous for systematically silencing dissent and has racked up a worrying toll of human rights violations against both Saudi citizens and foreign migrant workers in the kingdom. African migrants incarcerated at a Saudi prison speak of the inhuman conditions they have to endure.
The biggest problem is COVID. 400 people in one room, and no social distancing. We only have 3 toilets. Many people are sick. I got sick.
The place is not clean. We cannot sleep properly. 180 people are very sick. We appeal to the prison to give us medication. And instead of medication, we were beaten.
The massacre and persecution of these innocent Ethiopians and migrants from other parts of Africa is clearly an act of impunity by the Saudi regime. Now, why is the regime acting with such impunity?
The establishment of the state of Saudi Arabia was based and anchored in duplicity and treachery. We are all fully aware of the history of the Emiratis and the Saudis, that they had partnered up with the Western world to dismantle and devastate the Ottoman Empire. And this has now led to them consolidating power within the region. And since 1945, it has been the United States that has been keeping this atrocious regime in power. The deal was security for oil. The United States would provide armaments, troops, and support within the region, and the Saudi regime would provide oil. Therefore, the United States became beholden to the Saudi regime and turned a blind eye to these atrocities. One just has to look at recent examples. You look at the war in Yemen and the mass atrocities that have been committed there. However, the United States is not just a bystander. It is an active participant, providing in-flight refueling capabilities to Saudi jets, providing weaponry and intelligence, and they have been complicit in the massacre of innocent people within Yemen.
Well, Western powers have a long history of ignoring the heinous crimes and human rights violations in Saudi Arabia due to high dependence on Saudi oil and billions of dollars worth of arms sales to the kingdom. The Biden administration recently awarded Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's impunity by granting him legal immunity, a move that angered many, even within the establishment in Washington.
The continued massacre of African migrants by Saudi forces is conveniently ignored by Western powers claiming to champion for human rights. Clearly, black lives are not important for these hypocritical Western powers.
The United States of America, as we know it today, was built on the back of slavery. And this is precisely what the Saudis are doing at the moment. They are building their life of ease on the back of these immigrants and these foreign laborers. It's very hard to understand that United States, which was founded on slavery, which continues to support regimes that effectively place their populations and immigrant populations in slave-like conditions, would have any qualms around that and advocate for equality and justice when they have the very same problem domestically and they are trying to come to terms with the reality that they are a terrorist state. And they continue to terrorize people on a domestic level based on the color of their skin. We just have to look at George Floyd.
Tens of thousands of Ethiopians are to have been repatriated from Saudi Arabia over the past few months after enduring immense suffering in Saudi Arabia. These Ethiopians have to return home lest they face a fate similar to that of their compatriots who are being massacred by Saudi forces. An Ethiopian speaks here after returning home.
We cried every day. They gave us a pot of cooked rice for 300 people. 400 people were living in one room and we couldn't see sunlight. Please return the others who were in prison.
Ethiopia has started repatriating thousands of its citizens facing persecution in Saudi Arabia. Now, do you think the government of Addis Ababa has taken enough measures to hold to account the Riyadh regime for its crimes against Ethiopians?
Well, it's a good thing that they are repatriating people. It's unfortunate that there are many countries in the global south that depend on this forced migration of people who they can't employ, who can work elsewhere in the world, who then send money back home to family and help support their economies. There is not enough of an effort in many of these countries to protect their citizens. I'm glad to hear that Ethiopia has repatriated their people, but this is not enough. There needs to be solidarity among the countries whose citizens go to Saudi Arabia and other nations in the Persian Gulf to work in order to protect them or to keep them from entering altogether. But as long as there's this inequality among nations, unfortunately, I think this trend will continue.
In March of this year,
The Global Fund to End Modern Slavery, published prevalence estimates of forced labor among Kenyan and Ugandan citizens who traveled to Arab states of the Persian Gulf, especially Saudi Arabia, for employment. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary of Foreign and Diaspora Affairs, Alfred Mutua, speaking at the country's parliament during his confirmation hearing in October, vowed to ensure that the suffering of Kenyans in Saudi Arabia comes to an end. He also noted that many dozens of Kenyans have died in Saudi Arabia over the last few months.
It is quite unfortunate that as we sit here, Kenyans have died and have been mistreated in some parts of the world where they go to seek employment. It is quite a shame. I found out that we've lost 85 Kenyans in the last 3 months, and about 1,000 have been repatriated, especially from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, where they have gone. I've looked into the matter and I've seen systematic failure in systems, from how they are recruited here and how they are let to operate in when they get to Saudi Arabia and other places.
As we have seen, it's not just Ethiopians who are bearing the brunt of Saudi brutality. Reports indicate that nearly 100 Kenyans have been murdered under mysterious circumstances in Saudi Arabia. Now, what is the situation of other African migrants in Saudi Arabia?
Other migrants continue to be under the boot of the Saudi regime, and that's simply because of the system that is prevalent not only in Saudi Arabia, but as well as amongst the Emiratis. We just look outside even of African migrants. We look at the 1 million Filipino, Sri Lankan, and Indonesian women that are currently working within Saudi Arabia. Even if you look at the private sector, 80% of the workers in the private sector in Saudi Arabia are foreign nationals and foreign immigrants. And when you look at the system and you look at the atrocities that have been taking place, because they happen to be foreign, they happen to be so desperate that they have to take these jobs, they are heaped with abuses, they are heaped with torture, they are heaped with sexual abuse. It is very clear from the recent reports out of Human Rights Watch that these individuals work longer than 12 hours a day, they have unpaid salaries, and they continue to be subjects of sexual violence as well as rape by these individuals that call themselves responsible bosses and responsible employers within Saudi Arabia. This is the state of affairs of the Saudi regime. It is turning, even if you look at it from a cosmetic perspective, the state is turning into a satanic, pharaonic state, and therefore workers' rights are very low on the agenda of anything in terms of justice and prevailing justice.
Thanks, Zakir Ahmed, for that. Indeed, Saudi Arabia is increasingly turning into an evil kingdom where migrants are likely to face sudden death. We now take a short break before we continue with today's topic on the massacre and suffering of Africans in Saudi Arabia. Stay with us.
Massacre of Africans in Saudi Arabia.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Our topic this week is on the massacre of Africans in Saudi Arabia. Now, we continue with our guests today, Mr. Zakir Ahmed and Margaret Kimberly. Now, despite the fact that Saudi Arabia is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, it detained thousands of African migrants in very inhuman and dreadful conditions, reminiscent of slave trade camps as part of a drive to stop the spread of COVID-19. Now, Mr. Ahmad, why would the wealthy countries such as Saudi Arabia resort to this brutality?
I think there's two parts of it, and I think it relates to the first question that you placed to me about the arrogance of the Saudi regime. Because they have been so blessed with wealth, it is believed that the wealth gives them the rights to do as they please, when they please, and to whom they please. It then does create this dystopia now in the minds of the Saudis, where we have this world of comfort, and you have these individuals that are dependent, that are completely reliant on the work that is being provided, and therefore they are viewed as subhuman. Even when you look at the pilgrimage, the Hajj, or the Umrah, you get a lot of feedback from people that do not happen to be Arab, and they always say that you are treated as less than nothing. You are always viewed as something other. You are always treated with a degree of racism and contempt. There is just this general view that those that happen to be of darker skin or from different regions are of a lesser nature than a normal human being, and they do not have duties, responsibilities, the right to dignity and respect. This is the thought that permeates the Saudi regime and continues to plague.
During slavery in the Americas, some enslaved people were set free after paying the masters who had bought them the shipping and purchase fee. Today, migrant domestic workers in Saudi Arabia are employed on similar terms. However, they can only earn freedom if they pay their sponsors some hefty amount calculated as the agency recruitment fee, visa fee, and air ticket. The Saudi kafala sponsor system for foreign workers has been described as modern slavery. This is a pointer that the abuse of migrant workers from Africa is an official policy.
What we often see is the extreme abuses taking place. There is no protection of these employees from confiscation of passports. We know it's an international law right and a basic human right, the right to movement and the right to leave an area by your own free will. However, this is taken away from them. And this is very similar to the manner in which the Israelis conduct themselves with the sieges of Gaza, for example, where you prohibit a certain number of people from leaving the locality and simply because of policy. Now we see the similarities in the conduct of the Israelis, and we see the similarities in the conduct of the Saudi regime. This is just institutionalized in terms of this this system. They call it employer visas.
According to an investigation by International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, foreign workers for defense contractors at least four U.S. military bases in the Persian Gulf are trapped in their jobs by abusive employment practices that they say prevent them from returning home or even looking for better work in the region.
Current and former workers interviewed by ICIJ are among the armies of men and women from Asia and Africa who do the manual and semi-skilled labor that keeps U.S. military bases abroad running day after day. The U.S. military operates from more than a dozen bases and other installations in the Persian Gulf and neighboring Iraq, and has used these locations to wage wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Migrant workers complaining about mistreatment are taken to detention centers, where some eventually die.
When we tell them our problems, they hit us. 5 days ago, a man was beaten severely. He was taken and never came back. They took one of my friends, and he was beaten severely. He was taken to a hospital, and that's where he died.
Now, migrant workers for defense contractors at U.S. military bases in the Persian Gulf region, including Saudi Arabia, are facing inhuman working conditions. The U.S. is certainly complicit in the abuse of African migrant workers in Saudi Arabia. Do you agree, Ms. Kimberly?
Oh, sure it is. The U.S. has been using people from African countries, from other Asian countries, in building and maintaining these bases. They did it when they were building bases in Iraq after the U.S. invaded Iraq. People from the Philippines, who thought they were leaving, were forced to return, as an example. But Africans, people from South Asia, from nations such as the Philippines, all of them can be victimized by these countries that have more money. And of course, yes, the U.S. is complicit, but also utilizes these means to get cheap labor. And there has to be an international call, an international effort to end this kind of exploitation so that people who cannot make a living in their own countries are not treated so badly when they travel abroad.
Several sources indicate that there is racial discrimination in Saudi Arabia. Afro-Asians constitute 10% of the population of Saudi Arabia. Black Saudis have fewer employment and education opportunities, and they are rarely in leadership positions. Most Black Saudi nationals generally fall into a lower socioeconomic group.
Saudi nationals of African descent are also subject to racial discrimination. Now, can we say that there is institutional racism in Saudi Arabia?
Oh, certainly we can, but Saudi Arabia is not alone in this. I mean, if all you have to do is look at a map and see the proximity of Saudi Arabia to the east coast of Africa to know that there are African-descended people there. The Saudis and other countries participated in a slave trade, so obviously there are African-descended people there. But when you, just as here, if you have that sort of history, there has to be a concerted effort to fight against the racism which created these conditions in the first place. So you're talking about a country that's not a democracy, that deprives its own citizens of rights, that executes people for very minor offenses, which does not have a true justice system. So the end result of all of that would be anti-Black racism.
Well, there you have it. The massacre, murder, torture, and mistreatment of Africans and people of African descent in Saudi Arabia stems from institutionalized anti-Black racism in the kingdom. I'd like to thank our guests today, Zakir Ahmed and Margaret Kimberly, for their insight. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. It was great having you. Goodbye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. Dear listeners, as you were with us with this commentary on Kumail's supplication. We reach this excerpt of this dua. Hayhat, ma dhalika dhannu bik, wa lal ma'ruf min fadlik. Far be it from you, that is not what is expected of you. Wa la mushbihun lima 'amalta bihi al-muwahhidin min birrika wa ihsanik, nor what is well known of your bounty, and nor is it similar to the goodness and kindness you have shown to those who profess your oneness. Imam Ali alayhi salam then continues, فَبِلْ يَقِينِ أَقْطَعْ, so I declare with certainty, لَوْلَا مَا حَكَمْتَ فِيهِ مِنْ تَعْذِيبِ جَاحِدِيكِ, that were it not for what you have decreed concerning the chastisement of your deniers, وَقَضَيْتَ بِهِ مِنْ إِخْلَادِ مُعَانِدِيكِ, and what you have foreordained concerning the everlasting home of those who stubbornly resist, لَجَعَلْتَ النَّارَ كُلَّهَا بَرْدًا وَسَلَامًا, you would make the fire, all of it, coolness and safety. وَمَا كَانَتْ لِأَحَدٍ فِيهَا مَقَرًّا وَلَا مُقَامًا, and no one would have a place of rest or abode within it. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this part of the supplication, continues talking about the chastisement of the deniers of the Almighty Allah. Now, as Imam Ali alayhi salam continues describing the fire of hell, he is not disappointed of the mercy of the Almighty Allah, none of the prophets or the infallible imams, and those favorite servants expected Allah to treat them with chastisement. The Almighty, who has called himself in the Holy Quran as the most merciful of the merciful, the forgiver, the generous, the lover, the holy, the fine, and the relenting, is not what we can expect from such a chastisement. The chastisement of the hereafter is not related to the believers at all. This is what the infallibles knew. It is the bitter fruit of denying the truth. It is the result of enmity with the Almighty Allah. The chastisement of hereafter is the reward of the proud and the sinner. It is the product of wrongdoing and corruption, and it is the result of human deeds and nothing else. That is why the prophets and the imams, the favorite servants, did not expect Allah to chastise them.
And how can the gods of hell threaten him when he calls out to you, my Lord? And how would you abandon him therein when he has faith in your grace to set him free? Unless that is not the concept of you, nor has your grace such a reputation, nor does it resemble that which you have awarded by your kindness and generosity. To those who believe in your unity, I definitely conclude that had you not ordained punishment for those who disbelieved in you, and had you not decreed your enemies to remain in hell, you would have made hell cool and peaceful, and there would never have been an abode or place for anyone in it.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So Imam Ali alayhi salam says, مَا ذَلِكَ الظَّنُّ بِكَ, Far be it from you, that is not expected of you. Why should the one who is not a denier and an enemy of Allah, while some rays of Allah's unity, belief, love and affection shines in his heart, and be possessed of righteous morality and virtuous deeds to some extent, be chastised? Such a person faces a holy and kind Lord, the one who invites any sinner to repentance in order to forgive him, the one who is waiting and waiting for the repentance to forgive them, the one who calls any broken servant to compensate his loss and any patient to cure him. Someone told a servant of the Almighty Allah, "I am polluted with wrongdoing. Do you think I would be accepted?" And he replied, "Woe be unto you. Allah calls his enemies and deniers of the truth. So how is it possible that he rejects someone who seeks refuge to him?" The late Ibn Fahd Hilli, in his book Uddatu Da'i, has narrated, "When the Almighty sent Moses to the Pharaoh to warn him of wrongdoing, he told Moses, 'Say to Pharaoh that I hurry more in forgiving the sins and being patient with the sinners than taking wrath and chastisement.'" So this is the kind of Lord Imam Ali alayhi salam is describing. This is the kind of Lord who has created us and is waiting for us to step only one step closer to him so that he can forgive us. That is why, وَلَا مُشْبِهٌ لِمَا عَمَلْتَ بِهِ الْمُوَحِدِينَ مِنْ بِرِّكَ وَإِحْسَانِكَ. If the ones who have professed to your oneness, this is not what you have shown to them. This is only goodness and kindness that we can see the others expect from you. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through half my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.